In the 1950s, lead was in paint and gasoline, but no one really understood how it was affecting our health, especially for kids. That took a pioneer.
We found that children who had high lead in their teeth had lower IQ scores, poor language function, and poor attention.
I'm Kara Holsapple. This week on the Allegheny Front, the story of the doctor who first sounded the alarm about lead poisoning in kids. Plus, a former Republican congressman is trying to rally his party around a solution to climate change.
Conservatives have a very undeserved inferiority complex when it comes to energy and climate.
And a tree that grows and grows up into the heavens, but is more of a devil when it comes to native forests. Those and more environmental stories are coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. This week, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers released a long-anticipated study detailing the best ways to prevent Asian carp from getting into the Great Lakes. Elizabeth Miller of Great Lakes Today has more.
The report analyzes three ways that invasive species like Asian carp enter the Great Lakes: swimming, fishing, or hitchhiking. The recommended plan would keep an electric barrier near the southern tip of Lake Michigan and blast noise there to bother the fish. There would also be water jets designed to remove small fish and boat launches located upstream and downstream of the Brandon Road Lock and Dam. The National Wildlife Federation's Drew Youngdyke says the Army Corps' $275 million plan looks promising.
When they use those different technologies, each one may have some weaknesses that are covered up by the other. So it looks like they're kind of making them run a gauntlet where even if they can make it through the first one, that second one's going to keep them from getting through.
The report was originally scheduled for a February release, but the Trump administration delayed the release amid concerns from legislators and members of the shipping industry. Illinois Lieutenant Governor Evelyn Sanguinetti says Monday's report will hurt the Illinois economy and its commercial navigation industry. For Great Lakes Today, I'm Elizabeth Miller.
Asian carp are a huge threat to biodiversity in the Great Lakes because of their appetite. People are worried the carp could wipe out native fisheries there. Here's another invasive that's becoming a threat to Pennsylvania's forests.
Ailanthus altissima.
Or tree of heaven. That's Matt Kasson, an assistant professor of forest pathology at West Virginia University. He first started studying ailanthus at Penn State. And this is a tree that you know.
Ailanthus looks a lot like sumac or walnut. It has a compound leaf that it has a central stem with leaflets coming off to the left and the right of it, forming kind of a fan-shaped leaf. A beautiful tropical-like appearance.
It's a tough urban tree that sprouts out of sidewalks and came to the U.S. from China by way of England in the 1700s. And since then, it's thrived. It's found in 40 states and most of Pennsylvania. And Kasson's new research clues us into why.
We've known for a while now that ailanthus is pretty aggressive in colonizing the landscape. But what was unclear to us, and really the motivation behind the study, was to figure out its reproductive potential. If you drive down the highways right now, you could see these brilliant red to orange colored seed clusters, prolific seed production on individual trees. But we wondered, how much seed could these trees actually produce in a single year and over a lifetime?
And what did you find?
Well, we found that there are some exceptionally reproductively capable individuals across the landscape. We found one tree in particular on the campus of Penn State University that routinely puts out about 700,000 seeds a year and has been doing so for almost a century. So the cumulative seed production of that tree is somewhere north of 50 million seeds over its lifetime.
That seems kind of remarkable.
Right. Now, that's an exceptional tree, but we found that on average, a tree that lived 40 years and was reproductively capable during that window could produce upwards of 10 million seeds. I think viability is a really important aspect because if a tree can produce a million seeds per year and viability is 3%, well, that's not a lot of reproductive capacity. But if viability is north of 70%, like we found on our a few of our individuals, including this 104-year-old individual in Pennsylvania, the potential for producing a lot of progeny over a lifetime is exceptional.
So why is this tree's kind of super reproductive power and its spread a problem?
It wasn't always a problem. And I think the way that we manage land and landscapes have changed over time. Following another invasive pest, the gypsy moth, we saw widespread land clearing, which really set up these forests for ailanthus. Gypsy moth has been here since the 1800s, and it's started to devastate forests in Pennsylvania and throughout the Appalachian region, late 70s, early 80s. And we saw widespread salvage harvesting in the aftermath of this gypsy moth defoliation, because the defoliation was so severe that it actually killed a lot of the oak trees that were occupying these ridge tops in south central Pennsylvania and in elsewhere throughout the mid-Atlantic. So one reproductively capable female tree at the edge of this clear cut seeded in the whole clear cut, and now you're left not with native trees regenerating, but a whole entire stand of invasive trees.
Is this something that's worrying for foresters?
Absolutely. Tree of Heaven not only can outcompete native species that might seed into those same clearings, but it also produces compounds that inhibit the germination of native plants. It's called allelopathic, and what it does is it produces these compounds that make the site more suitable for itself to regenerate and less suitable for native plants. If we think about the spotted lanternfly, which is a new pest that's just been found in Pennsylvania in Berks County, it actually requires Tree of Heaven to fulfill its life cycle. It feeds on the foliage. It lays eggs on the stems. And it's a real threat to the grape industry. Tree of Heaven is pretty well established throughout most of the counties in Pennsylvania, with the exception of few of the northern tier counties. So in that sense, it could follow Tree of Heaven up towards Erie and up to New York into the Finger Lakes region, where it could directly threaten and impact the grape and wine industries in those regions.
How can you get rid of them? Can you cut them down, or what are some of the ways that you can remove them?
I've been working on biological control using native fungi to kill Tree of Heaven in these forest settings for about a decade now, but there's still plenty of stands of ailanthus that haven't been controlled. And until they're removed, whether it be through biological control or chemical applications or mechanical removal, they're going to continue to be underproductive forests that supplant native species and prevent future generations of native forested stands from establishing.
Tree of Heaven is commonly thought of, I think, as an urban tree. How did they move into the forests?
Yeah, that's a good question. For a long time, it just kind of hung out in Philadelphia and in New York as kind of a botanical oddity passed around among early botanists. And then seed-producing trees were established, and soon seedlings were available through a lot of the nursery trade. And followed the railroad corridors east and west, we noticed a huge spike in the spread of Tree of Heaven in Pennsylvania following the completion of the Horseshoe Curve, which connected the east and western part of the state. Tree of Heaven moved along those transportation corridors, much like they move along our interstate highways now. But as to how they got in the forest, with building of roads and things like that, we see movement of invasive species, whether it be through gravel or just that there's a lot of exposed soil, which allows prolific seed-producing species to establish. There was a recent study done out of Penn State that showed that these Marcellus shale well sites are now being taken over by a number of invasive plant species. We predict that Tree of Heaven will follow suit because it does occur up in those northern tier counties, but they're not really widespread as of yet. But with all this new road building and road construction to support the gas industry, I think we'll see a lot more spread of these invasive species that are common throughout the southern part of the state.
Okay, well, thank you so much for talking with me.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate it.
Matt Kasson is an assistant professor of forest pathology at West Virginia University. And there's a lot more about his research into Tree of Heaven at our website, AlleghenyFront.org. This is The Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple. Back when a Pennsylvania doctor first discovered that kids could experience irreversible damage to their IQs as a result of contact with lead paint, he got a lot of pushback from the industries that depended on it.
A kid in the inner city has all kinds of problems, right? They said, the lead is one teeny piece of this, and the effect is minimal. And Needleman thought any effect at all was criminal.
Coming up later on the Allegheny Front, Herbert Needleman, and why we're still talking about kids and lead poisoning. Our region's dirty air is a big problem, but that doesn't mean we can't have a little fun with it, right? The Pittsburgh nonprofit Group Against Smog and Pollution, or GASP, has a new exhibit to make learning about air pollution and its impacts on our health a little more engaging. Producer Andy Kubis joined some community members as they checked it out. She started off at a display of lungs, pig's lungs.
It feels slimy, wet, and very squishy like a pillow.
Do these lungs look clean to you?
Yeah.
So that pig doesn't smoke, does he? Does that pig smoke?
And he maybe did not grow up in Pittsburgh.
Quinn from Aliquippa.
Did you see the pig lungs?
No, I didn't. Let's go look at it.
Real pig lungs, yep.
This is crazy. So somebody decided to just take the lungs out and just hang it up in front of us, like, and we pump. Okay, I'm with it.
They are actually the same size as human lungs. And so these are actually healthy pig lungs. And you can, when you pump them up, you can see how nice and full they get with full breaths. Now, we actually have a set of diseased lungs as well. They will not inflate as fully and as nicely as the healthy ones. And the whole point is showing is that when your lungs are affected by air pollution or by smoking, that you're not able to breathe as well.
I don't really care what my lungs look like as long as they help me breathe.
That's a good answer.
I'm Rachel Filippini. I'm the director of the Group Against Smog and Pollution. The whole point of doing this exhibit is that we know that air pollution is a serious issue that has serious consequences for people's health, but we didn't think you had to be so serious when we did education about it.
What are you guys doing over here?
We are making slime to represent boogers, because your nose is the first defense against air pollution, and so a lot of times the particle pollution, the particulate matter, caught in your nose hairs and in your boogers, and that helps keep it from going in your lungs.
Did you know that?
No.
Cool.
I like this.
Do you want to add any pollution?
The exhibit is meant to be family friendly and very hands-on. They can pick a huge nose where they can pull out air quality facts and learn more about air pollution in our region.
Here at number 5, air pollution can trigger heart attacks, stroke, and irregular heart rhythms, especially for those that are susceptible. Damn.
Pittsburgh's air is improving. But unfortunately, our air is not where it needs to be in terms of being healthy air. We still continue to rank very poorly on national rankings of air quality. We still have very high levels of fine particulates and ground level ozone and other pollutants that affect health. So while we've made progress, we are not where we need to be. And so this exhibit is to really educate people about the fact that we still have a significant problem, but let's not despair about that. Let's actually learn more about it and then be able to use what we've learned and take action.
Go, do you want to feel the lung?
Now you got
to. You have to be very gentle.
That was producer Andy Kubis at Assemble, a learning and makerspace in Pittsburgh, which is hosting GASP's Air Fair. Parts of the exhibit will be on display there for the rest of August. But if you can't make it to get your hands on some real pig lungs, you can see a video of them in action at our website, AlleghenyFront.org. And there's much more there about air pollution's effect on health in our region. That's at AlleghenyFront.org. We all know by now that Donald Trump is skeptical about the science of climate change. But he's not alone. A recent Pew study found only 11% of conservative Republicans say climate scientists really understand the causes of climate change. For our podcast, Trump on Earth, the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier spoke with Bob Inglis. He's a former South Carolina Republican congressman who now heads Republic EN. And spoiler alert, he accepts that climate change is caused by us. And he thinks he has a solution.
Can you explain your own evolution on climate change and kind of how you got to where you are today?
For my first 6 years in Congress, I was, you know, consistent with the tribe. Climate change was nonsense because Al Gore was for it, particularly since I represented such a conservative district in South Carolina. Then I was out of Congress for 6 years doing commercial real estate law again and ran for Congress again in 2004. My son came to me. He was voting for the first time. He just turned 18. He's the oldest of our five kids. And so he said to me, "Dad, I'll vote for you, but you're going to clean up your act on the environment." By the way, my son was not making a classic interest group threat. He was going to vote for me no matter what. But what he was really saying was, "Dad, I love you, and you can be better than you were before. So how about let's make this English 2.0, the new and improved version?" So that was step one. Step two was getting on the science committee, going to Antarctica, seeing the evidence in the ice core drillings. Step three was another science committee trip, Great Barrier Reef, snorkeling with an Aussie climate scientist named Scott Herron. And I could tell that Scott and I shared a worldview before any words were spoken, because I could see that he was worshiping God in what he was showing me. You know, St. Francis of Assisi said, "Preach the gospel at all times. If necessary, use words." And so afterwards, we had a chance to talk, and he told me about conservation changes he was making in his life to love God and love people. And I got right inspired by that. So I came home and, wanting to be like Scott, introduced the Raise Wages, Cut Carbon Act of 2009. Probably not very good political timing to introduce a carbon tax in the midst of the Great Recession. And it didn't help me that it's revenue neutral, which means you cut taxes somewhere else. It was just that I had crossed to the other tribe. I'd been seen as being untrue to my own tribe in the midst of that Great Recession.
So is that it? I mean, is it really just tribal? I mean, one of the reasons I was really excited to have you on was because I'm really fascinated by this question of why don't Republicans believe the science on climate change? And to be clear for our listeners, the science on climate change is clear. We're warming the planet. The primary reason is carbon dioxide. But a lot of Republicans and conservatives think this is a not settled science. Is it really, since Democrats think this is a problem, we are not going to think this is a problem?
Well, I think that it's that we conservatives have a very undeserved inferiority complex. We think we're no good when it comes to energy and climate. And so when the topic comes up, we tend to shrink in science denial when we should be engaging, because we're actually very good. We've got the answer. We know from people like Milton Friedman, a great father of conservatism, that what you do about pollution, well, you tax it, of course. If you pair that with a dollar-for-dollar reduction in other taxes or dividend all the new carbon tax revenue back to the people, it's revenue neutral, which is attractive to conservatives. And then, of course, you apply it to imports, and it makes it attractive because it means that you're making it in the world's interest to follow American leadership there. So it starts, I think, with an inferiority complex. And then it continues on with this. As conservatives, we haven't seen a solution that we like yet. And so what we have here is sounds like I'm a psychiatrist here, doesn't it? Another psychological issue, which is that we have something called solution aversion. We think that the solution is going to be a larger government that taxes us, that regulates us, that takes away liberty, that grows a nanny state. And so we reject the existence of the problem. And that sounds crazy, maybe, to some, to, you know, dismiss the existence of a problem if you don't like the solution. But here's a plan of surgery for that back problem you're having. First, we're going to remove your head. After we've got your head off, we work on your spine. Then we're going to put your head back on. You're going to say to me, "Thanks, doc, I'm feeling a lot better. I don't have a back problem," because the solution is nuts. And so in the case of climate, conservatives have heard, you know, some people running around with their hair on fire saying that we got to shut down industries and we got to stop the economy, stop all the gears from turning. Well, no wonder they're going to say, well, the solution's nuts. But what we live to show them at republicen.org is a very different solution that is actually a smaller government that simply puts the price in on all the fuels. In other words, adds all of their hidden cost to the fuels in a transparent, accountable marketplace, and then eliminates all the subsidies. Then there's a level playing field on which fuels compete. And in the liberty of enlightened self-interest, consumers will pursue their self-interest, and the result will be cleaner air and fixing the climate change problem.
The Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier spoke with former South Carolina Republican Congressman Bob Inglis for our podcast, Trump on Earth. There's a lot more, including how Inglis gets around denial when he talks to fellow conservatives about climate change and his love for a new electric car. That's at TrumpOnEarth.org. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapel. People have used lead and known it was poisonous for many years, like thousands. But it wasn't until the 1970s and the work of a doctor from Pennsylvania that we found out what we know today. Even small amounts of lead can cause long-term IQ deficits and learning disabilities in children. That doctor was Herbert Needleman, who passed away last month. We're re-airing this piece from Keystone Crossroads reporter Mariel Segura, who tells us Needleman's story and why almost 40 years later, we still have a lead problem.
It's 1957. We're at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, and Dr. Herbert Needleman is on his way to see a 3-year-old patient. Needleman's a young doctor, 6 feet tall, with brown eyes and dark hair. This is the first case of lead poisoning he's ever seen, and when he shows up, the girl is not in good shape. Her eyelids are drooping, her pulse is slow, she's not making a sound.
This girl was lethargic and you know, almost comatose.
That's Lydia Denworth, who wrote a book about Needleman called Toxic Truth. At the hospital, Needleman prescribes the girl medicine that gets rid of the lead in her blood. And over the next couple days, she starts to feel better. Needleman's feeling pretty good about himself.
He thought he had fixed her problem.
He talks to the mom and tells her, you know, your daughter's okay, but she was probably poisoned by lead paint or dust at your apartment, and you can't go back there.
And the mother just looked at him and said, well, where am I supposed to go? You know, she didn't have any money. She was a single mother. And suddenly, Needleman says it's like the scales fell from his eyes.
As a doctor, Needleman couldn't go home with his family and take the lead paint off their walls. This girl was probably going to end up back in the ER again. This patient marks the beginning of a lifelong crusade for Needleman. He goes on to make a huge discovery that changes the way we think about the dangers of lead. In the 1950s, when Needleman's a new doctor, lead is everywhere. Paint, pipes, toys, gasoline. You'd hear commercials like this one on the radio.
Drive up to the pump with the Ethel emblem and say, fill her up.
But Denworth says at this point, a lot of doctors aren't testing kids for lead because the symptoms of lead poisoning, like vomiting and seizures, look like other diseases. As an experiment, Needleman's hospital starts testing all kids for lead.
When they did, they began to see that it was far more widespread than anyone had ever thought.
After this, Needleman becomes consumed by thoughts of lead. This would be a good time to point out that everyone describes Needleman as a crusader against injustices, large and small. His son Josh tells a story about a canoe trip the family took when he was a kid. He and his father are paddling along a river, and they see a group of teenagers sitting around and smoking.
Generally, I think the kind of group that now as an adult I would try to avoid, and they were throwing rocks at a duck that was floating in the river.
Needleman gets really angry that they're trying to hurt this duck.
And he began to shout at them and said, leave that duck alone.
They're so shocked that they stop.
He could just not hold himself back when he saw something that was unjust.
Josh says the same thing went for lead. As Needleman sees all these kids come into the hospital with lead poisoning, he comes across a study from the 40s showing that children who'd been poisoned by lead later had behavioral problems and low IQ scores. And he starts to wonder, these children all had severe lead poisoning, but what about the smaller amounts of lead that most kids are exposed to every day? Could that be damaging their brains? He designs a study to find out. Lead builds up in the bones, so Needleman uses children's baby teeth to measure their lead exposure. He practices on Josh's teeth, which kind of rules out the tooth fairy. But that sort of myth would never have been a fixture in Needleman's home.
I can't imagine my father participating in a fiction in deliberately deceiving his children, even in fun. It's not the kind of person that he was.
After collecting the teeth, Needleman and another researcher test the kids to see if the ones who have high levels of lead also have these cognitive problems. Here he is describing the results in a PBS documentary years later.
We found that children who had high lead in their teeth, but who had never been identified as having any problems with lead, had lower IQ scores, poor language function, and poorer attention.
The findings are controversial. Critics, including companies that make lead products, say these things can be caused by other factors, like family life and education. Denworth explains.
A kid in the inner city has all kinds of problems, right? They said the lead is one teeny piece of this, and the effect is minimal, even if there was any effect at all. And Needleman thought any effect at all was criminal.
The research has an impact. The Environmental Protection Agency has already started phasing lead out of gasoline, and in the 80s, thanks in part to Needleman's research, it speeds that up. There's also a federal ban on lead pipes. And then the government puts out a plan to eliminate lead poisoning for good. It says more children should be tested for lead, and that we need to get lead out of kids' homes so they're never poisoned in the first place. Needleman testifies in front of Congress in support of a bill that would fund those efforts.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. I'm Herbert Needleman.
His hair is gray now, and he's wearing wire-rimmed glasses and a beige suit.
There is a broad consensus on the part of everybody except the lead industry and its spokesman that lead is extremely toxic at extremely low doses.
He calls removing lead from gasoline a public health triumph, but he says there's more work to do. The idea of getting the lead out of homes, there's a lot of resistance to it from landlords and realtors who say it's too expensive. The bill and others like it don't pass Congress. In 1992, Congress does pass a law requiring landlords to disclose lead paint hazards to tenants, but it can be hard to enforce. In the meantime, Needleman's worried about something else. A couple scientists who represent the lead industry in lawsuits accuse him of scientific misconduct. They say he cherry-picked his data to prove a point. Here he is talking about that accusation in the PBS documentary.
If you're found guilty of scientific misconduct, you're out of business. Your reputation is ruined, you're through.
The University of Pittsburgh, where he's working, investigates for almost a year and finds no scientific misconduct. It says Needleman mischaracterized some of the procedures in his study, but not in a way that changes the findings. As time goes on, more and more studies show effects of lead at low levels, but government agencies stop talking about eliminating lead poisoning entirely. Some people say public health dollars are better spent on other problems, like obesity and diabetes. People make that argument today, too. Lead levels in young children have dropped by more than 90% since the late 70s, when Needleman did his first studies. But a lot of kids are still exposed to lead, through dust, old paint, and pipes. And the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says no amount of lead in the blood has been proven safe. Denworth says Needleman always felt like we hadn't done enough.
It became old news. We thought we'd solved the problem, and we never really were willing to finish it.
And that's why, despite all that's changed, kids still show up at the doctor with lead in their blood. And like Needleman back in the 50s, there's only so much that doctor can do. Marielle Segarra, Keystone Crossroads.
Thanks to Keystone Crossroads for that story, which first aired last year. Herbert Needleman died on July 18th. He was 89. For more reporting on lead, head to our website, alleghenyfront.org/hiddenpoison. Thanks for listening to this week's show. We're also on Facebook and Twitter at Allegheny Front. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments and the Park Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of conservation.